This episode is brought to you by Backwards Planning Financial with Joe Garrison. It's also brought to you by Ideal Poultry, by Private Family Banking, and finally, this episode is brought to you by Salt and Strings Butchery. Welcome to this episode of the Hard Med Podcast. I'm your host, Eric Kahn. Delighted that you could join us. And we have a phenomenal conversation today with Mr. CJ Engel. We're going to be talking about a number of really interesting things, including some of the encounters that CJ had recently with Jenna Ellis. That's right, the lawyer, the Trump lawyer, was coming after CJ and really going hard after CJ and particularly Christian nationalism. A lot of this is tied to James Lindsay and what's been going on with G3 and a lot of those movements, which are very much opposed to Christian nationalism, apparently not opposed to Israeli nationalism. What a weird week. A lot of crazy things going on in the Middle East. And all of a sudden, people are calling for like mass genocide of Palestinians, people who are against apparently Christian nations, but jumping on this bandwagon. So I think very pertinent will be this discussion. CJ and I had this, of course, before any of the events with Israel this week. But I think we'll be very pertinent, like I said, to the discussion of current events. We're also going to talk about a number of things, including political theory, that I think will prove very interesting. We're going to talk about No Enemies to the Right, Charles Haywood, and what does that mean, No Enemies to the Right? And then finally, we're going to talk about Franco. Why are people talking about a sort of Christian Franco? What does this mean? And, you know, how does it fit into the current moment? I think a lot of people are waking up. We continue to see unveiling. You know, COVID was one unveiling. Well, we've seen another one, again, as I said, this week with the events of the last couple of days. And so anyway, I think this is going to be a fantastic conversation. Always appreciate CJ's insight. So we'd encourage you to check out this episode. If you do enjoy the Hard Men Podcast, do us a favor. Go over to iTunes. You can leave a 5-star review. That helps get this show before more and more people. Again, appreciate all of our listeners and would definitely encourage you, if you're not yet a Patreon supporter, you can sign up today for as little as $5 a month. We're going to be talking about this and more on The Pugilist, which is our Patreon exclusive show. Pastor Dan and I will unpack more and more about the Israel situation and how that impacts Christianity and Christendom. You see a lot of competing ideologies at play. And so that's going to be a really good discussion. We also do a lot of pastoral theology there, how to find spouses, what things should you be looking for, and why you should reject boomer think on so many of these issues. Again, you can find that at patreon.com/Eric Kahn. Follow the link in the show notes. We'll take you there for as little as $5 a month. You can join, and that also supports this show. We are going to jump in now to this episode with Mr. CJ Engel. Well, welcome to this episode of the Hard Men Podcast. Of course, I am your host, Eric Kahn, joined today by CJ Engel. CJ, thanks for joining me for this episode of the podcast.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
So, CJ, I kind of one of the things that intrigue me most, I've gotten to know your Twitter handle over the years. Pretty spicy. But recently, because of Christian nationalism and some other things, you got into it with Jenna Ellis. And I found myself asking the question, why does Jenna Ellis care what CJ Engel is saying? I guess for people who aren't aware, what happened? How did that originate? How did you get into it with Jenna Ellis? Who, by the way, a lot of people may not know this. I believe one of Trump's lawyers. She was arrested with him, and so high profile, etc. How did this all come about?
Well, it came about because of another mutual friend, so to speak, James Lindsay, who constantly retweets me and quote tweets me, and interacts with me because he's blocked several Christian nationalists, and many Christian nationalists have blocked him. And I'm one of the few that he still sees, apparently, although I've muted him. But it was his interacting with me that I think caught Jenna's attention. The Christian nationalist theme has been going around, and it's a lot of fun. I think it's educational in a lot of ways. You know, people are just using it as sort of a vehicle to rediscover just a more historical more theologically rich approaches to the questions that still haunt us today in our secularized, liberal, left-wing dominated world. You know, there's a lot of answers there that have been sort of neglected. We've been, I would say, spoiled enough to be able to neglect some of these more difficult foundational questions. That gravy train is sort of coming to an end, and I think a lot of people are having to rethink things, and so that experience is creating a lot of camaraderie, and on Twitter especially, there's a lot of people that get together, and they have a lot of fun with it. I mean, there's no reason why we shouldn't be having fun and enjoying each other's and our opponents respectfully, but you know, one of the outcomes of that, if you're in the right crowd, like I am, I have a bunch of Twitter accounts that have more members than me, and they've taken a liking. And of course, that means that I get in front of people like James Lindsay and Jenna Ellis. And so that's sort of how it came about. Jenna's an interesting case, though, and we'll probably get into this more because she has drawn the ire of the Biden regime. I mean, she is under fire because she is not in step. She's out of line. You know, she's not completely compliant with a lot of their narratives and objectives and agendas. And she's, you know, she's someone who I would think should be more willing to question just what's at stake and where things are, and just the possibility of sort of recreating the world from 10 years ago. I mean, she's someone who's been slapped in the face over the last year, and there's no reason why she, of all people going through this, shouldn't be questioning. Maybe there's more going on here than just a simple Democrat-Republican spat, you know? So that was surprising to me. And we'll get into the details, I'm sure, of the controversy, but that's sort of how it came about.
Yeah, and it's interesting because one of the things that I've questioned about this whole thing with, you know, there's kind of a couple levels. Christian nationalism, there's Christian nationalism, Stephen Wolf, Moscow, that whole matrix of, you know, they published his book and so that drew a lot of attention and ire and all sorts of reactions. Then you move into the G3 camp, and you have a lot of guys who, you know, recently were having a, you know, Stephen's a kinist and, you know, Owen Strand and all those people. They're really upset about Stephen. But I was a little shocked with the Jenna Ellis thing, like you said, and maybe even James Lindsay, because it's like James is an atheist. Somehow, I think James is driving the ball on this, but somehow he decided that Christian nationalism was like against what? I don't know. My question to you is, what is it about Christian nationalism that sets somebody like James off?
Yeah, there's a couple things. I do think he does point out often that there's sort of this manufactured, like this is why we get called Nazis all the time, because they're trying to create this like big scare thing, you know, and it's a rationalization or a justification, I should say, for some of their more anti-heritage American, you could even say anti-white policies that are coming down the pipeline. And I think they want to create these really scary boogeymen as a rationalization for some of the things that they have been building actually since the war on terror was initiated. There's a lot of laws and surveillance and authority that's been given to the administrative state to take some very significant steps in, you know, stepping on people's throats a little bit. And so I do think they want to create this boogeyman. And James Lindsay interprets this very grassroots development as this conspiracy that's actually consistent with the State Department's efforts. And so I don't know where that misreading comes from, but I think that's what's going on. He thinks it's going to be used as sort of a false flag, which is possible. And I think as Christians, you know, anybody listening to this who's on the right, they need to be aware that, you know, you can't just... You need to take everything with a grain of salt. You need to watch out for false flags. You need to watch out for Fed baiting. You need to watch out for all these kind of things. Like the January 6th, like a lot of us knew before it even happened that this was a trap. We need to be aware of this because, yes, they are going to target these people because anybody who considers themselves a Christian nationalist is a threat to the ideological foundations that make up our current, you know, regime narratives. So I do think that there is an aspect of that that's, you know, decent, and we need to pay attention to that. But I think it's hilarious, the idea that Stephen Wolf is like this plant, right? Like he completely misreads who Doug Wilson is. He's been at this a long time. You know, he is not friendly with the regime. He's not working with them or anything like that. So those things are kind of loony. I also think that a regime that's ideologically desperate is going to find anybody who is most confrontational ideologically, religiously, philosophically, with their own deep-seated commitments. and they're going to make enemies out of them because they can't stand it when somebody opposes them. You know, the function of phrases like free speech or the open society, all those things are meant to put a boundary on discussion, you know, not to open it up. And so we're outside of that boundary. And I think that it's sort of a reaction to that sort of threat.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. One of the other questions I have. So recently reading the R.R. Reno book, Return of the Strong Gods, which I think you probably have read. One of the interesting things about that is I see a lot of people on the right, especially the Christian right, who I don't know if they don't know, they're unaware, but I see them running the plays of the post-World War II consensus. I see them buying into that narrative of what America is supposed to be. So they're actually the ones using the you're a Nazi, you're, you know, all this language. They use all the language of really they want to support democratic pluralism, which I don't. So my question for you is, I guess, explain for me the post-World War II consensus, and let's start with that.
The post-World War II consensus is sort of the thing that we all grew up on. I mean, what is the meaning of America, and what unique aspects of the American experience really defines her uniqueness? I think that's the liberal consensus. I don't think people thought of America in the way that we did, like let's say in the 80s and 90s. They didn't think about America like that, even in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. I mean, even in the 50s, this whole thing was an attempt by the United States regime to oppose the Soviet Union. That's what it was kind of constructed as. You know, it was meant to be this eradication of anything that could be seen as a threat from the right, because we had just undergone this large experience of defeating, you know, for whatever we can say about it, you know, the United States did lead the world in defeating the fascist movement, the Nazi movement, and other, you know, forms.
And that's what you mean about the right. They think that's the right.
Well, yeah. So what happened is anytime someone would oppose what America was doing culturally in the world, they would call that the far right. You know, they would say that, you know, but at the same time, there was a new enemy on the scene because we had basically defeated Western and Central Europe. You know, they were gone. Europe's role in the world had basically, you know, gone away. It was done for. And the two victors of World War II was the United States and the Soviet Union. And so on one hand, we had to oppose the right because that's what we had spent the last, you know, 5 years, you know, hitting hard on. And then we also had to oppose now this new threat, which was on the left. And so this liberal consensus was this attempt to balance it, you know, not to be too extreme on the right and not to be too extreme on the left. The threats in the 60s and 70s were on the left. The right had been defeated. You know, and so this liberal tried to walk this line between them. And in order to do that, they had to create a mythology of the United States that could account for a lot of the changes that had taken place over the prior, you know, 10, 20 years, but especially in the 60s. I mean, the whole idea of a propositional nation, I mean, that's really 70s and 80s talking points. I mean, that's really pre-Reagan, and then during the Reagan administration, that was the sort of height of, you know, propositional nation. So we couldn't talk about things in terms of, you know, cultural experience, ethnic experience. We couldn't look for homogeneity in our population. We couldn't look for things like that because we had overcome those scary right-wing threats to liberal democracy. And that sort of became the myth. So that's what I consider the liberal consensus. It's neither. It was an attempt to shut down the extreme right, so-called, and shut down the extreme left, so-called. And it was this attempt to straddle the middle, you know, and to sort of be this last bit. But the problem with that, as we'll get into, is it completely lent a blind eye to threats within the house, you know, threats within the castle, which are not on the right. The threats in the 60s and 70s were on the far left. They weren't a Marxist left. You know, Marxism was coming under severe scrutiny, but it's sort of a post-Marxist left that emphasizes a lot of the Western contributions like psychology, even, you know, efficiency in capital, efficiency in financial markets. It would emphasize identity issues. It would emphasize race and sex and all those things. So it wasn't this Marxist left, it was a post-Marxist left. It wasn't an economic left. It was more of a cultural left. And that's sort of what took place. And nobody really noticed it. Well, some people did. And they got kicked out, of course, of the conservative movement. And they got kicked out of the liberal establishment as well. And this centralizing effort, this agreement between, you know, the moderate conservatives and the moderate liberals sort of came together and created this consensus. And both sides attempted to shift away from the extremes on either side of them.
Yeah, that's really helpful analysis. My question to you, you know, as you look at all those problems, you've mentioned what happened in the 60s. We could probably talk about, you know, post, you know, the Civil Rights Constitution, post 1964 era. That's a big part of this as well. Do you see that consensus is crumbling right now? If so, or if not, why?
So I think it's the fruition of a lot of themes during the 60s, for sure. But the liberal consensus itself has already been taken over. That's what the new left is. That's what the new left has done. Liberalism is always transitory. It's always ripe for whoever actually wants to conquer it. That's its weakness. I mean, this is something that the far left thinkers like Antonio Gramsci noted. It's also what far right thinkers like Carl Schmitt noticed. People on both sides, James Burnham, Christopher Lash, who was an old leftist, they all recognized that any system that was unwilling to define its own positive vision, except for in neutral terms, was ripe for takeover. And that's exactly what happened. So I do think the liberal consensus basically collapsed in 2008. I think that's what happened. And then, you know, the response by, you know, the big capital was to sort of double down, capture the cultural aspect of things and remake the world from a left-wing perspective. So yeah, liberalism is dead. And it's just a matter of who's going to win from here. You're either going to be exterminated or you're going to have total victory.
Our sponsor, Private Family Banking Partners, is on a mission to help Christians live out the Dominion mandate by making a stealth-like move away from the mainstream banks and into their own privatized banking system. This innovative system is designed to guarantee uninterrupted compound interest and tax-free growth without exposure to typical stock market risks. To join this growing community that is already building wealth into future generations and converting post-mill talk into post-mill action, contact Private Family Banking partner Chuck De Laderante at his email, chuck@privatefamilybanking.com. Again, that's chuck@privatefamilybanking.com. To set up an appointment and to receive a free copy of Chuck's new book, Protect Your Money Now, How to Build Multi-Generational Wealth Outside of Wall Street and Avoid the Coming Banking Meltdown, go to the link in the show notes for more information. Do you desire to be shrewd financially for the sake of your family and future generations? Well, we know that a robust society depends on getting this right. Success in building and passing on personal wealth. Let's be mature, responsible leaders with the resources God expects us to turn a profit on, to love our children and children's children well. Joe Garrisey with Backwards Planning Financial integrates investments, debt, insurance, tax strategies, and legacy planning in a holistic approach, coaching his clients to act wisely. You can do better than you received. You can affect your family's trajectory and maximize your efforts to set up long-term fruitfulness. Joe starts with your values and goals, then provides impactful counsel to help you form and implement your financial plan. Click on the link in the description for Backwards Planning Financial and contact Joe today to get started. Yeah, it strikes me as interesting because when, you know, I think some of the ideas for that would, you know, form the basis of Christian nationalism obviously have been around for a long time. I can even think of a lot of it, you know, reading Death of the West with Pat Buchanan. You can find a lot of the ideas there in a lot of the, you know, paleocon movement and stuff like that. But it's interesting to me the timing of when Christian nationalism really hit the scene. And also, I think the reason that people are so scared of it who oppose it is because they see it's actually a potent thing. I think that, and correct me if I'm wrong, I want to get your take on all of this in terms of why Christian nationalism took off when it did. But I think, okay, 2008, 2020 is another pivotal year and the shamdemic and everything that happened there. I see the younger generation as like, I'm tired of this. Like there's a upheaval happening. And so maybe that makes people open to consider some different possibilities. Curious your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think in the midst of crisis, and you know, crisis is something that everybody recognizes, except for those who are in positions of like the opinionators, you know, like the opinion writing class, anybody who's, you know, makes its money basically stuck in an office. You know, Roger Scruton always used to talk about this. He used to grapple with, why are philosophers always on the left, you know? And it's because they're run by, you know, like highly difficult and complex theories instead of just catering to their own sentiments and instincts, you know, and that's why you see this, you know, massive bifurcation between like the ideological classes and sort of the rural, you know, blue collar working man class, which are sentimentally, you know, more, you know, conservative. It's funny. My own grandfather is a sort of a blue collar Democrat, a union Democrat, you know, very anti-immigration, would never in his life dream of voting for a Republican, but he's very like union. He's very anti-immigration because he's scared that his, you know, job, just instinctually that his job was under threat by mass immigration. But it's just funny because like I told my other friend, I was like, he isn't intellectually sophisticated enough to recognize that he needs to be okay with the immigrants. You know, he's just always had that working class Democrat attitude. But those things are actually more conservative than where the Republican Party has taken us over the last 20 years.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely true. I guess at this point, if you would kind of describe, I know there's some variation here, but like there are people who are going to hear this. And I think people who have followed on Twitter and they're like, okay, first of all, what is Christian nationalism? How do you define that as a movement? I guess let's start there. Just kind of start unpacking for me, like, what is it? And, you know, is it tied to Stephen Wolfe, et cetera, other thinkers in this movement?
I think the best way to approach it is a broad umbrella. You know, I'm not a good propagandist. So when I first encountered the phrase, I didn't like it. I didn't realize that because of the phrase, we're all talking about it. If it, you know, if it was this like highly, like I like the big words with hyphens and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So I'm a terrible propagandist, and I didn't really like the phrase because I didn't think it was accurate enough. But the phrase itself is part of the reason why it's drawing people's. It's starting the discussions. You know, it gets people frustrated. It gets people mobilized. It gets people energetic.
You have to respond to it.
You have to, exactly. It draws conflict, and conflict and confrontation, if handled well, are very healthy things. You know, they are the things that are drivers of growth and development and edification, you know, when you have those things. So the phrase itself, I would consider a broad umbrella. There are people operating under the phrase that have just more of a Reaganite instincts. You know, they miss the age of like Jerry Falwell and the religious majority, you know, the religious right and the moral majority and all those things. So those are generally our allies. I'm not going to sit here and like beat up on them. You know, they're not my enemies, but those are part of it. You also have people that are like very strong and strict theonomists, like the Mosaic Covenant is still binding today, and therefore all the judicial laws are still binding, and they should be used as leverage to limit, you know, our own government overreach and all that stuff. So those are part of the broad umbrella too. I would consider Stephen Wolfe to not be part of that. I would consider him to be more of the classical magisterial continental tradition of thought that borrows the two kingdoms, you know, paradigm, the two kingdoms framework that, you know, has leveraged things like Thomas Aquinas or Calvin himself or Turretin and some of those. Those are more consistent with even some aspects of like, you know, the Church of England's political experience. So it's a very broad, but I think in general, what we want is a recognition that secularism is actually leading us toward a positive vision on the left. Secularism is sort of a tool that's being wielded against us to keep us away from power and to destroy our way of life. And so I think we all recognize that secularism and liberalism is kind of a scam, and it's only done us damage, cultural, religious, and sociological damage.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting because the engagement, I guess, is what I've seen. There's a lot of dishonest engagement. I think, obviously, in any discussion, conflict, as you mentioned, you're going to have people who are willing to engage fairly. Again, going back to things like Owen Strand, you know, Stephen will say, I'm not a kinist. In fact, you're pinning like Rushdoony kinism on me, and I don't, you know, I'm a magisterial reformer more than anything in classical two kingdoms. As you're watching all this unfold, and you see the it's either willful ignorance or smearing or whatever, there's intent there to misread. In one way, I see that and I'm thinking, okay, that means we're onto something. Like when I see people responding like that, I'm like, okay, what we have is potent. They hate it. We need to think through this. and utilize it well. I'm curious, just your read on sort of how maybe like G3 World to Jenna Ellis, you know, has responded to that. How do you read it? And then what do you do next, knowing that those things are true?
I think these people have spent a long time like convincing themselves that like buying into the myths of like the American age and the end of history. Like there's this phrase, the end of history or the last man. What it refers to is we've tried all the other political systems. We've tried forms of aristocracy. We've tried monarchy. We've tried all these other things. None of them have delivered on the goods. None of them have been able to achieve the freedoms that America has. And they totally convinced themselves of basically CIA talking points from the 60s and 70s about, you know, the nature of America. And so I think that they kind of see themselves that they don't play in the battlefield of actually having to lose your job because the products that you your grandfather used to build are now being made in Asia. They don't actually have to see the loss of their communities. They live in white collar world, and there's nothing wrong with being a white collar worker, but I don't think they see things. I don't think they have the willingness to see things at that level, and I think that they are unwilling to look at things from another paradigm. You know, and so I think it makes them uncomfortable. I think those people do like ideological comforts. I think they like to convince themselves that everything's going to be okay. I have this quote in my Twitter that drives Andrew crazy. It's, you know, optimism is cowardice. And I think there is a aspect of American psyche that's like everything's going to work out. You know, it's going to work out in the end. We're going to figure it out. Like, you know, there's just this psyche that things get better automatically. Like our children are going to live better than us because we live better than our grandparents. We have more things. We have more this or that. And we don't have to work as hard. You know, peace is rising. There's just this thing. We don't realize that there is a tragic essence to human life, and it's fragile, and civilizations do disappear, and cultures do go the way of the buffalo. Like, those are very possible things, and they're very scary. And I think that makes us really uncomfortable. And I think sometimes having that automatic instinctual, you know, optimism about the way things are going to go is a form of cowardice. They're not willing to look in the mirror and realize that we actually have to make political decisions. We actually have to confront actual enemies. It's going to require us to get our hands dirty, get our hands bloody. I'm not calling for civil war like she accused me of, but we do have to get involved, and it could get nasty. And as civilizations and as empires fall, things do get nasty. And that's the reality of history. The last man has been a complete scam. And I think we're about to face the realities of that.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. One of the other things I've noticed is a lot of the camps that are pushing back, even to G3, but this has kind of been like mainline Christianity. I've critiqued often on my show just pietism. And it's this spirituality that doesn't touch the real world. And particularly, I would say relevant and germane to this conversation, Christianity has not had a robust political theology for a long time. And so it seems like people don't even know where to begin. One of the things I found funny is people will criticize Stephen like he's presenting something new and reform people. And then Stephen's like, let me quote for you John Calvin in Turretin, right? Let me quote for you Thomas Aquinas, and then you can tell me how new my ideas are. And I think it's historical ignorance is baked into this. So I'm curious your take on the church. Like, just let's talk about the state of the church. Do you see that problem with a lack of political theology? And then a follow-up to that would be, how do we get out of that?
I do think America has not had a robust political theology because of its historical development. We sort of inherited this cultural heritage, you know, that came from our theological past, and we never had to deal with it. We never had to grapple with it. We inherited it. The problem with people inheriting things is that so often they can become to forget where it came from and forget its foundations. You know, you forget what your grandfather had to do to build something up that you can inherit. We've never had to grapple with this. So I don't fault the average person in the pews for not being aware of like obscure, you know, 18th century theologians in Germany. Like, you know, you can't fault them for that. But I do fault people who are supposed to be playing the role of the intelligentsia in our circles that have no intellectual curiosity whatsoever. That is a big problem. I think Owen Strahan, Strahan, right? Or Strachan? Strachan.
Strahan. Yeah, something like that.
I say Strand.
He has no intellectual curiosity about these political subjects. And look, some people are going to have such a commitment to, like, you know, philosophical and theological history that they're not going to have time for political theology. That's okay. But if that's not your thing, don't come in here and, like, be the judge that's you know, this know-it-all that actually has no clue. Because it's embarrassing, and everyone knows that it's embarrassing. Everyone knows that, as Andrew and I said, it was sort of a here-I-stand LARP. Like, we're so desperate to, like do this thing. And so it's really kind of awkward and cringy that he continues to bring these things up. And you can say that he has, like, bad intentions and he's trying to undermine us, all this stuff. But at the end of the day, I just think he has no clue what's going on. And so he's, like, literally just, like, from the seat of his pants, just, like, reading these things on Twitter and just regurgitating them, because he's not willing to do the reading, as Stephen Wolf says. And that's not everyone has to do the reading, but don't pretend like you know it all and that you have your thumb on the pulse of what's happening if you're not going to actually take time to pay attention.
Yeah, I think that's something. It's kind of a trend within social media, is we all want to be quick react, kind of experts on everything. And so because, quote unquote, everyone has a voice through social media, everybody thinks that they're an expert, which is not necessarily true. Even as I started I read Stephen's book. I think through the second read now, it was hard to digest. Like, it's a tough book. It's not easy stuff to think through. I think if you have read stuff like Samuel Rutherford and Lex Rex, that you're maybe going to be more acquainted. I have a philosophy background, so it wasn't insurmountable. What kind of got to me, and I was laughing about this, was I would get in discussions with just man on the street people, I think, on Twitter, and they would say things like, I haven't read the book, but I know it's bad because I heard what somebody said about it. And I was like, okay, let's pump the brakes on that one. We should. And this is where I think the failure of evangelical leadership, the leaders are smart enough to read these books and then to help their people understand them. I don't really see much of an effort on that front. They're certainly willing, you know, Rick Warrens and people like this are certainly willing to push lady pastors and push the vaccine and stuff like that. But could we get an honest discussion? I think it's just a dumbing down and a selling out of the evangelical establishment. CJ, I do want to ask you this, because I'm sure people are wondering this. I've sometimes wondered. We kind of got to know where Stephen is on the spectrum. Where are you politically, theologically, on Christian nationalism? Where do you fall on that spectrum that you described earlier?
I would emphasize, first of all, I pretty much, you know, I can't think of anything. That's why I say pretty much. But I agree with Stephen's book. I mean, there's different types. I'm very much not theonomic. That's not my methodology, because I don't approach political problems as if we have to get our sanction only from scripture. I think we're allowed to get our sanction from history. If I can say the T word, tradition, you know, I think we can get our sanction from our own cultural experiences. But I also think that one of the teachings that I've derived from Calvin and people like Hooker, and I'll talk about Hooker in a second, but I've derived this really strong sense of the need for particularity. I think in political authority, God does sanction leaders to make decisions about unique situations in ways that historically have never been blueprinted for us to deal with. And I think there is the authorization for political power to use that. I mean, that's a very heavy burden for a political leader to have, that ability to make unique decisions on the grounds of prudence or particularity. So I really like that word, particularity. I am not a universalist. I don't think that there was a law for all times, and therefore that sort of precludes me from being as theonomic as some of my friends and co-laborers in this fight might want me to be. But I'm very much a particularist, and I read Stephen, and I know Stephen, and I've talked to him about these things, and I'm confident enough to say that he and I are on the same page on that. So I do follow him in that realm. I've also gained a lot of insight from people that did terribly during COVID, which is Brad Littlejohn and the Davenant people. I think their interpretation of what's going on in the world culturally, sociologically, even in terms of, like, the ethnic strife that's happening, I don't think they're at all prepared for what's coming down the pipeline. However, historically, I have benefited, and I did learn a lot from his studies on Hooker, because I think Hooker exemplifies that need for the political function in society to be particularistic. I do think that there are unique threats and there are unique avenues of defending a cultural heritage and a cultural patrimony that do allow political leaders to be flexible. So I get that from Hooker. I don't know if Brad Littlejohn gets that as much as I do from Hooker, because I think every situation is unique. In our situation, it requires unique tools to deal with a unique left. You know what I mean? So I gathered that from Hooker, and I have no problem saying that. So on that little divide, if people are aware of the Puritan versus conformist battles, I do have instincts and sympathies with the conformist crowd on like Hooker and stuff like that. So it's a really interesting mix, because in today's world, you know, Anglicanism is hardly worth defending politically. You know, most of my buddies on the right are Presbyterians and some base Baptists, but that's sort of like where I come historically. So particularity, I think, is a really important theme for me in my approach.
And for people who want to read more on Hooker, is Brad Hooker? Is that correct?
Richard Hooker.
Richard. Okay. Richard Hooker.
Yeah. So what I would do is, first of all, I would familiarize yourselves with the classical two kingdoms doctrine, because I think a lot of the rise of theonomy actually came about as a reaction to the modernistic 2K, which basically told Christians that they don't live in this world and they don't belong to this world, and therefore their fealty is in heaven only, and they should only fill their minds with so-called spiritual things, and that this world is passing, they don't belong here, they're pilgrims. And that sort of theology, I think, created the reaction of theonomy. I think it led people to Bahnsen and Rushdoony and North and some of those guys. And I'm familiar with those guys because I dealt with them when I was in the libertarian space a little bit. I think there is a role for the classical two kingdoms doctrine. And the very best book on this, and I think that Wolf would agree with me, is actually Brad Littlejohn's little classic, Davenant Guide to Classical Two Kingdoms. I think if you read that, you see that, at least for me, classical two kingdoms solves all the problems that all these modern 2Kers can't seem to get their heads around. So I would encourage people to read the classical 2K. And then also he has an introductory or a brief guide or something like that to Richard Hooker, that those two books by Brad Littlejohn are fantastic. And they helped me. And then there's all those themes are kind of interspersed throughout Stephen's book as well. So that's where I come from theologically. And theology is such an important aspect to the way I see the world that I always have to come back to it. I actually I want to get more into the political theory stuff, but I'm always driven back into the theology because it's the basis. I don't think you can look at things in a fair and accurate way without understanding the historical development.
Yeah, that's really helpful. The difference between classical two kingdoms and theonomy, where do you see the advantage of classical two kingdoms? I know we talked about particularity, but particularly in dealing with, say, current crises. I know there's guys kind of in this Christian national camp who are a little different on that, but maybe for the theonomists, like explaining classical two kingdoms a little bit and how it would be different.
Well, classical two kingdoms is different than theonomy, because theonomy conceives, it does two things. One, I think it treats our approach to problems as if they have to have biblical sanction at every level. There's a methodological approach there. They also see the structure of the covenants a little bit differently than I do. And Stephen might disagree with me on this one, actually, because he's more Presbyterian. I actually came from the Baptist world, and so I don't see the covenants in the same way as the Presbyterians do. And that I don't know if I want to get into details like that. But the other thing too is, I think what the two kingdoms paradigm offers, it's a way for us to seal off our spiritual citizenship as being, you could call it invisible. Richard Hooker called it our mystical citizenship. And throughout the entire world, everybody who's been elected, by God before the foundations of the world and is justified by faith in Christ, that's the invisible church and that's the invisible kingdom. And it's unmixed. There's no non-saved people in that church, that invisible church. But there's also our relations and our commitments to our family. We have obligations and duties to our natural family. And natural family refers to creation-based relationships. just because, you know, I have relatives that aren't saved, does it mean that because they're not in the spiritual kingdom, I therefore can abandon them and I can treat them as exactly the same as some random person in Cambodia? I can actually have a natural instinct of fealty and duty and obligation to their well-being because I also live in the created kingdom. I also live in the natural kingdom. And the natural kingdom is, of course, mixed. There are saved and there are unsaved. And we have a duty before God to build these kingdoms because we're human beings. And that's what Adam had been tasked with, is building kingdoms. And that's what human beings are for. They're to create dominion and they're to rule the earth. And there's these natural obligations. And I don't think that all these created and natural ties have been cut off and severed and burned because of the coming of Christ, because I believe that grace restores and it makes us able to fulfill our natural created obligations and duties. I don't think it severs them at all. And so that's what the two kingdoms offers. It offers this perspective of no matter what happens on this earth, I have citizenry in heaven. But in the meantime, I do have obligations and duties that are part of my humanity. I forget which book of the Bible calls these people that ignore their family obligations as sort of like, you know, worse than, you know, devils. I think that's the phrases that it uses. Yeah. So I do see myself as belonging to two kingdoms, and I have duties in both, you know, and preaching the gospel is great. And preaching the gospel is the mechanism by which people can also join the invisible kingdom. But I don't think there's a call for neglect for our family duties. In fact, Paul emphasizes this over and over and over again throughout his letters.
Yeah, no, I think that's really helpful. Before we move on from Christian nationalism, I want to ask you about the particular, well, this is one of the spicy tweets in question. So this is from Jenna Ellis, and she said, and there it is, CNs, and she's subtweeting you, CNs want a new revolution and demolition of the Union and the Constitution, and they're willing to use force to achieve it. This is an open call for civil war. Every, all caps, American must, all caps, reject this Christian nationalist movement. And for point of reference, your original tweet was, totalitarianism is what we have now. No Christian nationalist supports this. Many of us actually support the breakup and crushing of the United States regime, and we are willing to use political means to do it. Let's start with your tweet. What are you trying to convey here in the original tweet?
There's this idea that we're a free people, right, and Christian nationalists are one of the threats to that freedom, and that we are approaching freedom by wanting to bring in tyranny. That's the framework through which James Lindsay, Michael O'Fallon, Owen Strain, or whatever, that's the framework through which they're critiquing Christian nationalism. I reject that framework. My framework is the Constitution was great when it was a thing. Now it is not a thing. And in fact, it is used as a rhetorical bludgeoning device to prevent conservatives from fighting back. That's the function that the Constitution plays. The Constitution died 100 years ago. You could say it died in stages. There's particular moments, you know, throughout the last several hundred years that it was, you know, really given, you know, a severe blow. But I think that during the Progressive Era and the Managerial Revolution in the 1930s with the New Deal and FDR, and especially in the 1960s with the Civil Rights Regime, the Constitution is no longer in operation. But what it does do is it allows the Democrats to tell the conservatives, "Oh, sorry, you can't fight us here because that's unconstitutional." Like it is a very powerful rhetorical device against historical traditionalist classical conservatives, for sure. That's the function that it plays, and you can see that on display right here. Because when I recognize that the enemies are already in the gates and they're trying to trans our kids, and I'm recognizing that we can't just pretend like it's 1950 or 1940 anymore, that we actually have to think more serious and in more stark political terms. What do our so-called friends do? They say you can't do that because that's against the Constitution. They're playing right into the very way that the left wants them to play. So my point is not that we're trying to confront freedom with totalitarianism. My point is that we have a totalitarian government and we need to think of new ways of constraining it. And we need to think of new ways of defeating our enemies, which are trying to, exterminate us. So that's my point. Totalitarianism is here. Totalitarianism is not our solution. Our solution is how do we confront our political enemies? Liberty, I think, is downstream from confronting your enemies. I don't think that we can just say things like, we need to bring back liberty. That's not actually a mechanism of defeating enemies. That actually doesn't do anything. Like, I could love here, I would love to just say, let's recreate 1870. That was the best time in America. Let's recreate that. That's not a mechanism of power. That doesn't do anything. You have to actually be willing to wield power against particular threats. You know, the particular threats now are vastly different than the particular threats in 1780s when the Constitution was written.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And maybe, you know, this is where your quote on having a little bit of, less optimistic, a little bit of realism, I guess. But what hit me was like, okay, here you have, I mean, in my lifetime, in terms of anti-regime, like Trump is probably the closest thing we've had to any kind of resistance, you know. Outside of, you know, Pat Buchanan was a little bit before my time politically, but maybe there's another one. But in terms of being successful at a national level, Trump and some of the people close to him. And I'm watching these people go after Christian nationalism, and I'm thinking the best we have has no clue. Like, they are unprepared for the fight. So one of the things that it brought me to thinking through, especially as I started reading Charles Haywood, was I don't think the right is prepared to win. I don't think they're prepared to do what it takes to win. I don't even think, you know, as Charles will say, like, you have to want to crush the left. It has to be the party of idiots and losers in your mind, and you have to treat it that way. I want to get your feel on that. Do you think that's true? Do you have the same sense about the conservative, you know, conservative ink, but conservative movement and even some of the best movements on the right?
Yeah, I think about the Roe v. Wade issue, you know, and so what is that? 50 years of legalized legalized abortion, and just how many millions, tens of millions of dollars were absorbed trying to fight that. And when it was overturned, the grift ended, the abortion grift ended. So these Republicans, you know, this conservative movement, I think they're going to have to do a lot of furloughing and a lot of firing if we actually win. You know, they can no longer fundraise from, you know, old widows' pensions. They can't do that anymore if we actually win. So I do think they are hesitant to win. I think they've built an entire complex of compromising and of losing. And it's sort of like the loser industrial complex, and they can't afford to win. They can't afford this new right. They can't afford people like us on the right that are not interested in compromises. We're not interested anymore in shaking hands with people that want to destroy our way of life. We actually want to restore and renew the things that we hold so dear. And I don't think that they're prepared to win. I don't think they expect to win. And I don't think it benefits their retirement plans to win.
Yeah, I don't know if you heard it. The other day, I saw a clip floating around. Even Trump was talking about how the anti-abortion movement is like grifty. Did you see this clip? And I was like, wow, he's even calling this out. But I mean, for years, people were saying that. They were like, especially in the abolitionist movement, I would hear a lot of chatter and people would say like, you don't get it. Like, a lot of the pro-life movements don't actually want to win, because the minute they win, they're going to go out of business.
You can't fundraise on it.
Yeah. And you're going to, I mean, it's the same thing with environmental stuff. If there's not a scare, if there's not a state of fear, then you're not going to make all that money and fly around the world in jets and tell people how dangerous stuff is, you know? And so they've got to keep that racket going, which is sad to see. But I think, and this is where I want to move kind of in the last part of this show. Talk to me about Charles Haywood, Franco. A lot of people have no clue. They're hearing this for the first time, like Trump and RBG. I'm hearing this for the first time. With Charles Haywood, who is this guy? Why is he part of the discussion now with, you know, Christian nationalism and another term we might get into, which is no enemies to the right?
Yeah, so Charles blogs at the Worthy House. I've actually known about Charles for a long time before any of this, you know, was a thing, and before Charles was a thing. So he's been reading for a long time. But he's someone that recognized very early on, back when I was still libertarian, you know, flirting with, you know, anti-liberal, anti-democratic trends in our thinking. You know, I had corresponded with him for a long time, because there was a recognition that things weren't working as the myths said they were going to work. And I think Charles recognized that through his reading. And he carved out for himself a really great opportunity because he sold his business and therefore he's economically secure. He can't be fired. You know, the HR lady's not going to bring him to the office and reprimand him for something that he said on Twitter. That's a good place. It's a very freeing place. I mean, you're, you know, basically in that position. You know, I'm basically in that position. But when you're in that position, I think, and I was telling this to Andrew, you know, Isker, the other day, that you sort of have an obligation because there's so many of us are sort of we're imprisoned by our economic, you know, situations, which is, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. You need to take care of your family first, for sure. But for those of us that can say something, I think we are morally obligated to say something. And I think Charles has done a very good job at that. I mean, he could have kicked back and just, you know, consumed his way into his old age if he wanted to. But he is willing to confront these things. He's willing to talk about and popularize a lot of these ideas that he's been reading over the years. So Charles is someone who's absorbed so much obscure right-wing thinking from Europe, but also from the United States. That's basically transpired over 1,000 years. We have such a great archive of historical Western writings that deal with a lot of these difficulties, and Charles has absorbed that, and he's helping to shift the Overton window in a way that a lot of people can't. So I highly recommend his work. I trust his judgment. I trust his interpretation of things, and he does a really good job of interpreting both the lay of the land politically, but also the lay of land ideologically as well. So, you know, he's great. And I think you mentioned like Netter, but like these are the conversations that need to be having talked about, and he's doing that stuff. So I recommend people, you know, follow him and pay attention to him.
As a huge proponent of the carnivore diet, I quickly learned how great eggs are for you, especially when you slonk them 8 to 12 at a time. But whether you drink them raw or scramble them with some sausage, they're good for your heart and mind, and they help you build a ton of muscle pretty quickly. My preferred source for eggs is from my own backyard, and I've loved getting my birds from Ideal Poultry. Ideal Poultry is the number one backyard poultry supplier in the country, and they're also wonderful people. Ideal is owned and operated by a solid Christian family who is worthy of your patronage if you are looking for some fantastic birds. So visit Ideal Poultry today at idealpoultry.com. Again, that's idealpoultry.com. You can also check the link in the show notes. Red meat is a staple of a healthy, protein-packed diet, but not all meat is created equal. That's why I buy my meat from Salt & Strings Butchery. Salt & Strings is owned and operated by my friends Quinn and Samantha Bible, and the meat they offer is raised, harvested, and processed exclusively in Southern Illinois. It's cut and packaged by my friends Quinn and Anthony, and not only is it the best meat I've ever had, well, all their meat is sourced from local farms that share our Christian values. Salt & Strings is now offering a beef and hog box that can be shipped directly to your door. The 15-pound beef box features 100% black Angus beef and includes ribeyes, T-bones, sirloin, chuck roast, fajita meat, and ground beef. You can order your beef box today for just $259. They will send it directly to your door. The hog box is $239 and features premium Duroc pork, including 8 thick pork chops, one of my all-time favorites, pork steaks, cured and sliced bacon, ground pork, bratwurst, and breakfast sausage links. You can place your order today at saltandstrings.com or use the link in the show notes. And also be sure to follow Salt and Strings on Instagram. We'll also include the link in the show notes. Yeah, it's really interesting, and I want to ask you more about that. But something you said about having guys who are a little bit anti-fragile, at least to some extent, going out there and taking a beating. I heard this the other day because, you know, I'm going after all the whatever woke institutions and cultural idols of the day, whether it's feminism or whatever. And one of my favorite things is when the feminists say, oh, you're a grifter. I'm like, yeah, it's like telling John the Baptist, he's sitting in prison about to get his head cut off. And they're like, you know, this is pretty grifty of you, John. I'm like, you know, grifters should make money off of these things. But I do think there's a moral responsibility that many of us have. You're absolutely right to lay bare the problems. Cause there's a lot of people who, for whatever reason, it's like, it would jeopardize your job, whatever. There just needs to be more people that are speaking out about this. One of the things that I really appreciated about Charles Haywood, and one of the first things I read, this is probably a couple years ago, I guess, was his work on Franco.
And now it's funny because like Owen and some other people are like, you know, these guys were all about totalitarian dictatorship, have really like a, you can tell a 30-second cursory reading of who Franco even is, are not really engaging that fully. But I want to ask you, you can respond to that. And then I want to ask you just, who is Franco? Why does that matter?
I think part of the problem is that they have no concept of the political and what it means, you know? So they're like, okay, so do we want 1780s Constitutional Convention or do we want Francisco Franco? Well, Charles and all these guys want Franco, but I like George Washington. So I'm better. I'm more consistent with the American situation. Boom, case closed. Like that is a complete like annihilation of all of our contributions to political theory for 1,000 years, yeah. Right? The question is, for Spain specifically in the 1930s, was it better to have a military coup or was it better to have agents of Moscow? That was their option. Uh-huh. And why is Franco so popular then and now? Because Franco was preferred to the agents of Moscow. Okay. Yes, you're right. He's not a Thomas Jefferson accolade. Okay. So we get that, but that's not the debate here. And so these people can't think about things in terms of particularity. They can't think about things in terms of trade-offs, and therefore they have no actual concept of the political. They're ivory tower. This is one of the distinctions that I made in an article, you know, months ago, the distinction between legal theory and political theory. They're two different things. Legal determines, you know, what is the best type of law, you know, how, you know, to what extent should law be universally applied, things like that. But we're talking political theory. Political theory is how do you wield power in light of ever-changing situations and circumstances. Wielding has to do, you know, political theory has to do with things like sovereignty and authority and the exercise of power. Those things are distinct from legal theory. So we're not going to sit here and, you know, create a constitutional convention and come out with, you know, what is the best way to handle a British society in the 18th century. That's not what politics is. Politics is our, here's the enemy, here's what they're doing to us, here's our list of priorities, we're going to respond in X way given this list of priorities and given the things that are most precious to us and the things that are most demonstrably exacerbated right now with the rhetorical heat in the media and all these things. That's what politics is. So when we call for a Protestant Franco, not only are we saying that that's our ideal world, but we're also not saying that, you know, we want to make a Catholic United States. We're saying, here's someone who recognized a state of emergency and he took action decisively. We want to do the same thing because this is a state of emergency. All these other guys, I think they fall for the cowardly caterance to optimism that I talked about before. They don't want to face reality and therefore they're not willing to talk about things that sound scary to them.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. One of the areas where Charles... I was in Twitter Spaces the other day on this very topic of Netter, or No Enemies to the Right. I think it's pretty misunderstood. He's got an article on it. We can link to that. We've actually talked about it on the show before. But I actually found it very, very helpful. So I want you to break that down for me. Fundamentally, it seems like we've got this idea that was well understood on the left as part of their successful movement that, hey, if we attack each other, we're not going to defeat the enemy. So really it would be applying this to the right and saying, listen, you know, even I would even say like Christian nationalism, G3, I find it incredibly stupid for the most part. Yeah, we should be friends and our enemies should be the left and we should be working to take them out. Instead, there's a lot of infighting. Some of this may have to do with Protestantism and the very nature of what it means to be somebody who's always protesting. All that said, I want to get your take on Netter. First of all, what is it? And then how would you find it a useful concept in today's political arena?
Yeah, I think No Enemies to the Right, I think, is an instinct that recognizes that we no longer live in a liberal world. You know, I think Paul Gottfried, who's a personal hero of mine, he's someone who's influenced me a lot. He talks about the fact that, like, you could have these social clubs in, like, Victorian England where all the Englishmen would come together and they'd be, like, on vastly different spectrums of the English political spectrum, right? So you'd have, like, you know, people like Gladstone versus people like Disraeli, like, and that was the big spectrum. But they could come together and have a meeting of the minds because if one of them won, it didn't mean the extermination of the other one, right? No Enemies to the Right, I think, is an instinct that recognizes that that world is gone. And their people are actually interested and set on destroying us and eradicating our way of life, economically, sociologically, culturally, religiously. They have just no interest in keeping anything. You know, they want to turn everything into dust. And I think no enemies to the right. What it means is not that you can't have debates, not that you can't have disagreements, you know, not that we can't get in arguments or some stupid thing, not that we can't call each other out for stupid decisions that we make or stupid policy positions that we hold. What it means is we're not going to waste political capital canceling those who are opposed to those very people that want to exterminate us. That's what it means. It means that we're not going to help our enemies cancel those who would otherwise be our allies. That's what it means. No enemies means that we're not going to spend political resources. We're not going to use any ground that we gain in politics or in media or in rhetoric are not going to be used to help the left fight its war against us. I think that's what no enemies to the right means. So it's a helpful concept. It's abstract, and I think it just refers to an instinct. I mean, those that are saying, so you say we can't criticize Hitler? Like, it's just such a waste of time. You know, it's a recognition that there are friends and there are enemies. And I'm not going to spend my time going after people on 4chan. I'm going to spend my time I live in California. I mean, there's people literally wanting to try to take my kids away because I'm not willing to affirm whatever gender thing has been imputed to them by the public school. My kids aren't in public schools, but if they were, like, who knows what they would come up with, and they could be taken away from me if I push back on that. That's my enemy. You know, not people on Twitter, not people that are, you know, putting out edgy memes. Like, that's not my enemy. I'm not going to spend political bandwidth on those people.
Yeah, it's really interesting, too, because I think Charles points to, as an example in his article, of Rod Dreher being kind of like case in point of how conservatives will burn people just to their right. This has actually been going on for a long time, though. And you can think about things like William F. Buckley and what happened.
The John Birch Society.
Yeah, exactly. What happened even with Pat Buchanan being driven out of Northmen, north of Richmond, NRO. So, you know, north of Richmond Online. So this has been going on for a long time. It seems like it's a conservative instinct. My question to you is, why is that so ingrained? Because the left, they're very protective. I mean, if they've got an idiot on the left, they're like, ignore. We're going to go after the right, though. If we have an enemy on the right, it's like we are so allergic. We are so afraid of ever being associated with it that before even anybody even says that we need to, we're lining up to offer denouncements of the guy who's 3 inches to our right or left. So why for conservatives do we do that?
Because liberalism is our cultural hegemony. I mean that's it, it's the thing that defines the priorities. It's the thing that sets the framework and boundaries. I mean, liberalism, you know, leftism, liberalism and leftism are not the same, but really that like obsession with, you know, with tolerance and, you know, the liberal consensus, it's something that completely captured and absorbed the conservative mind. The left has done better at breaking out of that. It's been better at combating. That's why, like, you have like a standard liberal, like RFK Jr., you know, who would have been very far to the left in like the 70s. That's why he has, like, the New York Times and the Washington Post have absolutely no patience for him, because they've recognized that, you know, they're at war, and he is not part of that team. And so they're not going to cancel, you know, fans of, you know, Che or, you know, any of these radical Mao or any of these radical leftists. Who cares if they killed, you know, slaughtered tens of millions of people? It doesn't matter to them because that's not their enemy. You know, the heritage Americans are their enemy. That's who they're going to spend their bandwidth on. And the result of that is that they are masterful strategists. I mean, the left has conquered the Western world. And they've done so masterfully. And we're sitting here debating whether or not, you know, Paul Gottfried should be allowed to publish in our you know one of the worst offenders on cancel culture was Dinesh D'Souza, like in the 90s when he got Sam Francis fired from the Washington Times, I think it was. He got Sam Francis fired. I mean, he was at the cutting edge of cancel culture, and you know, and now he's complaining about the New York Times canceling his documentary. You know, it's like, well, maybe you shouldn't have canceled people on your right. You know, maybe you should have recognized that Sam Francis was an ally.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. A good place, I think, for us to wrap things up. I just want to ask you one more question. And I think if I could get anybody to start reading books on you know, in the political spectrum, I'm generally going to say, you know, read Pat Buchanan, I know we're not allowed to say it, but you need to read Sam Francis. You can still find articles. These guys saw problems 20 and 30 years ago, well before their time on a lot of these issues. And I think a lot of them paid the price for it. So paleoconservatism, Paul Gottfried, definitely somebody to read. I know you've written and spoken about that as well. I guess making a plug for this, if people aren't familiar with what I'm talking about, why are these guys so important as thinkers, particularly in this cultural moment and political moment?
Well, first of all, they saw what was happening. You know, they recognized that, you know, what's happening right now is the end of a long process. And you need to pay attention to the people that recognize that the problem doesn't lie with the fruit. The problem lies with the foundation, you know, and I think a lot of people are like Ben Shapiro. They're, you know, they critique the fruit of things, but they're not willing to go to the foundation. So you need to recognize those people who saw what was happening when it was happening. So you could read people like Garrett Garrett, like who's like a 1930s, like anti-New Deal guy. People think they've got like no relevance to today. But if you see the stream of events that took place over the 20th century to get us here, you can see in him a willingness to look beyond the veil and see that things were going to happen that have happened. And they saw it, they saw why it happened, and they saw what could have prevented it. Those are difficult things to read because it makes you, I don't want to say black-pilled, but it does make you realize that we are up against a mountain. We are up against masses that have been completely brainwashed. We're against elitists who are obsessed with their own drugs and their own addictions. And, you know, all the things that they're pushing on us, they're actually true believers, which is really scary because they have a sort of a element of zealotry, you know, to their efforts. But you need to recognize that these things go back and they don't just start in the managerial revolution. Of course, you need to read, you know, the counter enlightenment people. So I would say that the reason to read those people is because you can't accurately conquer a beast unless you know where it came from.
Yeah, that's so helpful. If you had to list top five books for people to get started, what would you recommend here?
So I would look up Joseph Scotchy. He's written a lot on like, you know, the sort of revolution from the heartland. I think, you know, he's done a lot of work on like paleo. I think his book on paleoconservatives is hard to find, but he's got a couple other books like, you know, he's got a lot of works on just people that over the years that have recognized that, you know, Heritage America was under assault and like in the 70s and 80s. I mean, these are the people that Pat Buchanan read. You know, these are the people that sort of, you know, allowed him to take the red pill. So I would look up Joseph Scotchy. If you're more academically minded, Paul Gottfried is great. His book on the conservative movement, I think it's called just the conservative movement in America. That book really shook me. He's got a really difficult academic style. So if you're not ready for that, you know, you might want to, you know, just start with Pat Buchanan or something. But if you really want to decipher the conservative movement, what happened, how it happened, you need to read Paul Gottfried. He also has another book, Multiculturalism and the Politics of Guilt. And he interprets sort of the collapse of liberal progressive America into the new left and how the conservative movement was sort of like a gatekeeping enterprise from the very beginning. You know, he's had his thumb on that pulse, you know, for a long time. So Paul Gottfried, Sam Francis, he's actually, if you like the more, you know, weighty intellectual stuff, he's got a book on political theory, you know, formal political science book called Leviathan and Its Enemies, which is a good book. But I think the best you can do, and I've promised and teased paleoconservative reading list for some time now. Eventually I'll get it done and I'll have more of a, you know, step one, step two type approach. But yeah, those people I think are worth getting started on.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, I appreciate it, CJ. Thanks so much for coming on the show. Definitely appreciate the conversation. And for our listeners, you can follow CJ on Twitter. His handle is Contra Mordor. And hopefully we'll have that in the show notes as well. But again, CJ, wonderful conversation. Thanks again so much for coming on the podcast.
I enjoyed it. Thanks, Eric.
Well, thanks again for listening to this episode of the Hard Men Podcast. And special shout out to our Patreon supporters. If you're not yet a Patreon supporter, you can join today for as little as $5 a month. And that definitely helps keep this work going. We are glad to partner with you for content that builds a new Christendom and reclaims biblical masculinity at the same time. You can check the show notes for the link to become a Patreon supporter of the Hard Men Podcast today. Stay frosty, fight the good fight, act like men. Thank you.